KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, Matt Bomer, somebody I've been trying to get here forever.
Oh, my goodness.
He's finally made enough time to show up and talk to me for a few minutes here.
Oh, please. I'm so happy to be here.
You have a low threshold for happiness, but you're way too polite. But you're here for your new film, Papi Chulo. And one of the things that's so cool about this movie, and I've noticed about you as an actor, is the way you use your voice. And the voice always speaks about the confidence of the character. Mm. And we can tell just by listening to it, because I actually experiment and just listen to it and didn't watch for it the second time for about 10 minutes. We can hear that he's just trying to hold on, can't we?
Yeah, he's definitely ratcheted up pretty high, and there's a lot wound up inside, so he goes up into his upper register quite a bit. Yeah.
But we can also just sort of hear the quaver a lot of the times,
yeah,
too. You can hear how unsure he is. I want to talk to you about that, because that vocalization for you, I was just thinking of comparing this to a walking out.
Mm-hmm.
Where we can hear all the confidence in the voice, mm-hmm, and how he uses his voice basically almost to intimidate people.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk to you about that vocalization of yours. It's so sort of specific to character, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I guess I first learned about it in drama school, and, you know, you never want to approach a role from any kind of overly histrionic or overly wrought manner. But sometimes when you're working on the inner life, things just start to speak to you. And when you start to think about the history of the character and really delve into where they are emotionally, physically, if you're lucky, it can just happen naturally sometimes, just if you let yourself try to inhabit those circumstances. And so I guess sometimes it's more of a conscious thing that you try to make unconscious, and then sometimes when you're working on the subconscious, it can just bubble up to the conscious.
Well, how conscious was it here for you?
It actually wasn't terribly conscious for me here. It was more, this was all about, I had to start with the pathos of this character and what was going on with him emotionally. He'd just come out of this horrific breakup. And
we should say, yeah, you're playing an L.A. weatherman who's,
yes,
an incredibly lonely guy.
Incredibly lonely, and he's really spiraling. I mean, the film starts out with him having a nervous breakdown in the middle of the weather forecast, and it is in a very kind of Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm-esque way where it has to be real, and as an audience, you really should know if you should be laughing at this guy or should you feel guilty for laughing at this guy, but it is inherently funny circumstantially. So I wanted to start with where he was emotionally and let everything else kind of unfold from there. And once I got to his state of mania and his inability to really ever be able to sit still with himself in any real way, things sort of spawned out of that.
I guess I sort of contrast it too, because almost all the other characters in the movie are pretty confident, and he is not.
Yeah.
So we're sort of constantly seeing him when he's around other people being tested by that.
Yeah, yeah. I think John Butler is a fascinating writer and director, and so collaborative, and really constructed the world in a way that there was no safe space. Even his home is not a safe space for this character. He can't be comfortable at home. He's talking to the walls. There are remnants of his ex that are there that prevent him from being able to sit still or be comfortable. There's this deck that he's constantly trying to fix because he feels like if he can just get this deck fixed, everything will be fine. So the world, entire landscape of the piece that he's constructed has made this character feel like he can't light anywhere in a safe way.
As you were talking about that, I was just thinking about that scene where he has a grinder date, and even in his own home with somebody where he should be comfortable, he's not.
Yeah, yeah, and even his identity, he doesn't really know how to present himself to the date either. And it is, in a weird way, he realizes just a way to try to re-engage with his ex in a very unhealthy manner. He's even bad at grinder dates, which seem pretty straightforward to me, you know, like, we like this, let's meet up, let's do it. And this time went, like, you know, how complicated can it be? But of course, for Sean, it is so full and wrought, and he has to get drunk and, you know, just, of course, ends up just selling the whole affair.
We're talking about a new low for the character in the film, Poppy Chula, with my guest Matt Bomer. It's the treatment. But I also, too, the voice also really attends to the physicality. I mean, he's somebody who doesn't know what to do with his body. I mean, we see how wound up he is initially, just that, in that weather forecast where he doesn't know what to do with his hands. And that's the one thing TV weathercasters always they concentrate on their hands because it's the one thing they have to do. They can't do anything else.
You just point to the temperature, pal. Yeah. Even when he's waiting in line, you know, even when he had to, and this is a testament to John Butler, the director, who there were even moments when he's waiting around in a hardware store and he doesn't know what to do or how to stand. His whole body is crossed and he's trying to, you know, fiddle with things that he doesn't even understand instead of just sitting there comfortably. He just can't do it. And it was, I'm thankful that John left the camera on me for moments like that, because there was no reason to keep the cameras rolling. I was just trying to stay in character.
But it also gives you a way to turn that anxiety into a kind of a physical comedy, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I think that kind of internal tension is so key to comedic roles, particularly if you want to ground them in some
type of reality.
I almost felt
like I was watching Jack Lemmon in some ways. How did you do that?
Oh, my gosh.
Because there's that nervousness that he played out so often and so well. I thought about that in watching this.
I mean, that's the ultimate compliment. I wish I could ever achieve those heights, but that's what we were going for, you know, is that level of anxiety, for sure.
And it's also, it really kind of speaks to this fact that he doesn't know really how to, it's interesting, a character who's a communicator who doesn't know how to communicate with people.
Yeah. I think he's realizing as well how much he leaned on his ex and how much of himself he gave over to that relationship, and that now that it's gone, he is trying to figure out how to reclaim his own identity because he'd given it over to somebody else.
And it's interesting, too, because with the exception of Ernesto, everybody who meets him or comes in contact with him makes an assumption about him.
Yeah. I mean, my goodness, being a local weatherman, I mean, we all grew up with one. I think you inherently have ideas about who this person is. And I think he has, you know, played up that image in the past, and he just doesn't know how to hold that mask up anymore.
I guess I was wondering, too, because as somebody who's identified publicly, how much of your own life you really bring into this, the expectation people have about you when they see you.
Oh, I don't know that I've ever denied who I am to somebody. You know,
people have an expectation about what you are.
Yes, of course. Yeah, and I think you have to find an honest means of engaging without feeling like you're having to perform 24/7 in your downtime as well, you know. But I worked with a director very early on who said, listen, you're going to be recognized at some point, and just think about a time when that happened for you. And that can be like Christmas Day for somebody. And you can either, you know, go to the bathroom on somebody's Christmas, or you can make their Christmas dream happen or whatever it is. And they just may want to say hi because they thought they saw you maybe somewhere on a guest spot somewhere. But if some people, it does mean something. And so you try to engage in a way that's true, but that you're not having to like play the character that they are relating to.
I guess I just thought this movie was so interesting. Again, especially Buttress Against Walking Out, just because of the physical demeanor of these guys. I think about so often that you play people who use their confidence as a way to sort of basically play games with people. I was thinking about Monroe Starr in The Last Tycoon, where he's basically playing Monroe Starr to some extent with people.
Yeah.
And when he's with people he knows better, then that goes away. So this idea of your perception of character's persona and how they deal with that.
Yeah. You know, in a weird way, I feel like almost that Walking Out, I mean, I based Walking Out on a very specific person, but it's something like White Collar, you know, that's almost something I have to reach out farther for than somebody like Sean, because I have, you know, I, Sean and I are certainly very different, but my life tends to play out a little bit more like a comedy. Things like the dropping of the keys when he gets out of the car, those are just things I improvised, or having to do the 17-point turn when he leaves. Those are things that just kind of happened in the moment, because sometimes that's just the way life plays out for me.
This is a great moment, which really made me think of Jack Lemmon, when he just can't get the shoulder harness to work in
that
the
was
car.
A moment that just happened. It was a really manic thing, and I didn't even know if they'd gotten it in the take or if they'd cut, but it just happened, and I went with a over-the-shoulder
harness
on the seatbelt just would not strap, and it's at a point of real frustration for the character, and so I tried to take it out on that seatbelt, and then he has a moment where he finally lets himself take a deep breath, and it finally works.
That wasn't scripted. That was just improvisation.
It was improvisation, yeah.
It's
always a testament to the director when that happens. I don't like to take credit for improvisation, because I think probably most actors worth their salt can do some form of improvisation. It takes a really confident storyteller to allow you to improvise and to have the courage to keep the cameras rolling and seeing if something's going to happen in that moment, because they very easily could have cut.
What was your first conversation with John like? What did you guys talk about?
Well, I really responded to the script right away.
Had you seen The Stag before?
I hadn't seen The Stag, and I hadn't seen Handsome Devil.
Okay.
But I thought, this guy is an amazing writer. And I just knew that I understood the character on a gut level pretty early on in reading the script. And I couldn't put it down. And then there's a pretty big turn in the piece around the middle, and that just hit me really hard. So we Skyped, actually. He was in Ireland. And this was financed, actually, through the Irish Film Board. So they flew over an Irish camera crew, and then it was like a half-Irish, half-American crew, which was amazing. But we had a great conversation about the piece. I think he responded to what I understood about the character, to what I wanted to bring to the table. And he was really funny. He had a great sense of humor, which I knew would be integral to a piece like this. And he came to L.A. We sat down, had coffee, and just hit it off and laughed and talked about the role and ideas. And I could tell immediately that it was going to be a collaborative experience, because I would say something and he'd say something back, and then we'd keep, you know, compounding what the other person was saying and going off in these directions. And I thought, okay, this is going to be really fun.
I just know, too, that this gives you a chance to use your comedy training. Because I know we talked to you before that you worked with the Groundlings and got your start there. And people tend to not think of you in that way. So it's nice to get to see you do that and also use your body in a way that you hadn't in a movie before.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of that's just a testament to getting to work with John and giving somebody who gives you that freedom. And that's one of the great things about independent film, is that there isn't some massive bureaucracy going, he's making really strong physical choices. I think we should tone that down. You know, you really are just collaborating with the director and the producers, the direct producers, and especially on a piece like this, and walking out as well. And I love that about the process.
But that gets back to me, too, about the kind of confidence. And you, I feel like you address these characters a lot physically first. You figure out who and what they are and how they move, and then it kind of goes from there.
Yeah, I try to. I it depends on the role. For me, I'm always trying to find the in the hook, you know. And sometimes it's probably like a songwriter who you know, sometimes the chorus comes to you first, or sometimes the melody comes to you first, or sometimes you just get a riff. So sometimes I'll land on something physically that really speaks to me that I can play off of, or sometimes it's just an emotional connection I have, or something that I've experienced in my life that really parlays into this character's world that I can tap into. So, and hopefully it's an amalgam of all those things over the course of a shoot. But I'm always kind of looking for what that first in is, if it's a character I don't know well. And a lot of times it's the physical life.
We'll take a break. We're riffing with my guest, Matt Bomer, who's starring in the new film, Poppy Chulo's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. The riff continues. It's Matt Bomer, the star of Poppy Chulo, is the treatment. But again, I just think of you, and I know you a bit, but we haven't really had that much time to talk. I've always thought of you as being a physical actor, first and foremost. And I just wonder if that comes from thinking of yourself primarily as a stage actor, where you've got to sort of occupy a space in a way that makes sense to people watching it.
Yeah, that might be part of it. It just depends on the project. But I think I always go back to that initial stage fright of, oh my gosh, what do I do with my hands or how am I living?
Is it that
simple? So in a way for me to find the physical life in a way that I know how this person's living or what they're doing or how they're behaving so I don't have to think about it. I can just sort of live in it. I mean, I think when I was preparing to do White Collar, I worked on that character's walk for a solid month before I put anything on film. And it's something that maybe nobody ever even noticed, but for me, it slipped me into the character. And
I was thinking, by the way, because it's almost like a dance.
It's
the way
a strut.
Yeah, it's almost like watching. It's exactly
there is, There is a dance involved in it. There's like a lot of like shoulder leg counter movements involved.
It's almost like you've watched John Travolta or something like that in Saturday Night Fever.
I had seen Saturday Night Fever. I didn't think about that at the time. It was just something I think when I got that job, I owned one suit and it was ill-fitting.
Are you serious?
So I think I would just put on that one suit and try to make myself feel as fancy as that character was. And then just like, how do I walk in a way that is all confidence, all bravura, all about look at me world. And that's what
happened. Because I was also thinking too, and I know we talked about this, about the physicality of the character in Normal Heart.
Yeah.
And how he's basically using that state to cling to life. Or you can see that hunger in him.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was essential. I count my lucky stars that I got to be any part of that story. I would have carried a plate across a restaurant scene in the background, you know. But the fact that I got to play Felix and, you know, there's a responsibility in playing that role and in Felix's struggle with himself. And I just thought, man, this has to be as absolutely real as I can make it. I have to be in a physical place where, like, I'm literally just trying to survive through the day. And thankfully, Ryan Murphy and HBO were really supportive in that for me and allowed me to shut down the production and do what I had to do to get to that space. But
because you lost a lot of weight for that second part.
Yeah, I mean, I stopped weighing myself after 40 pounds and we still had, I think, 2.5 weeks to go. And I wasn't a big guy to start out with. So it definitely got scary at a point, but that's kind of where I wanted to be, you know. I knew I was doing just enough to not get myself into real trouble.
But that appetite for life never goes away.
Never. Right? If anything, it emboldens you more, and you almost get to a kind of spiritual place in a weird way where you're able to look beyond the hunger and see a bigger picture.
Because I was, again, we go back to The Last Tycoon. Monroe Starr doesn't move a lot.
No, incredible economy of movement. And a lot of that is Janie Bryant's costumes. They were so phenomenal and spot on.
I hope you got to keep a couple.
I didn't. No, I mean, they were all, for the most part, real vintage. So
also, all like old studio costumes.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. And or things that had been constructed for other 30s set pieces. But even those were still sometimes, you know, 20, 30 years old. But she did such a phenomenal job with the tailoring. I mean, the fittings were kind of, you know, I was kind of tired actually by the end of the fittings because they'd be these 6-hour affairs because we'd be pulling everything out they had from the 30s. And, you know, sometimes the pants would fit perfectly, but the jacket would be tiny or vice versa. And, you know, a lot of them were 3-piece. And so we had to keep trying and keep trying and keep trying until we got 3 things that we could actually work with. But yeah, I kept that characters, you know, he's supposed to be a pretty frail guy physically, so I kept him pretty lean and hungry as well. And the tailoring and the way you move in those kinds of clothes and the power he holds allowed him an economy of movement.
But there's also a lot of drama in the way he moved, too, as if he's somebody who's used to being paid attention. So I was aware of the way you always had your hands in front of you. I mean, so
yeah.
often. And that,
yeah.
that was intentional, was it not?
Yeah. Yeah. And the way he walked around, I won't tell you what I did, but I did something really weird and abstract just to
really?
Figure out.
No, you can't tease us now. Come on.
Well,
you can tell us what you did.
I put on a crown. And I walked around in the suit with a crown, which sounds so esoteric and weird. But he was the king, the little prince of his domain. And so I just wanted to see what that did for his movement. As he was a gracious prince, but I wanted to see.
Not always.
Not always, but a lot of the time.
Okay.
So I wanted to see how that affected how he moved through the world.
It's a treatment. We're talking to princeling Matt Bomer, the star of Poppy Chew.
I'm not allowed a crown in my household.
Whatever, watch this. Whatever you say.
I had to throw that off.
I'm not here to argue with you. I'm just asking goofy questions. But I was just wondering if there, as a kid, are the actors that you watched or the people around your house who you just kind of watch that? Because that consciousness of physicality is a good, something I think is kind of unique to you.
Well, you know, honestly, I did grow up, I lived in kind of a restrictive religious household where there were times when we'd be allowed to watch certain secular things and sometimes we wouldn't be allowed to watch them at all. So I would actually have to use my imagination a lot of the time. And then I'd get bouts where I'd get to watch a lot of like reruns of old sitcoms or you know, really classic TV shows. And then there'd be windows where we got to watch a little TV at night. So I got to see like the Simon and Simon and Magnum PI block. But my brother and I were always renting movies and kind of watching them behind and wherever we could in the safety of, you know, without adult eyes around. So there was some of that, but I think a lot of information actually came to me from just going to church as much as we did and seeing all the different kinds of people there and the performers there and even just going to a potluck dinner and seeing the way different people would behave at those dinners and the kind of mannerisms people would create and the way they held themselves and then playing sports in Texas. I think, you know, it was just there was as much information coming from me, from my life as there was from, you know, the movie screen. And it was only until later years that I, once I got to college, that I got to start to really dive into the classics. I think you were there. You hosted the first Truffaut film I ever got to see, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Oh, my gosh. That's
I missed those. French Film Fridays.
Yeah.
Remember that?
I vividly missed those myself.
Can we bring that back, please?
They don't have a theater at the LA County Museum anymore. I'm sorry. You just gotta do what everybody else does and get the Criterion Channel.
It was the coolest thing.
But I was going to say, though, you were that generation of the Texans who dressed up to go to church on Sunday before it became a casual thing when people stopped dressing up.
Yeah, I mean, I think
so. No, I'm just saying that
pictures of me as a child where I was like, I looked like Boss Hogg, like I was like full blown at the Easter sunrise service. That's an important detail. We went to the sunrise service where you went to church in the dark and the sun rose behind the preacher as the sermon was happening. But I was fully decked out in like a white suit. Full white suit.
Little Monroe Star.
Little Monroe Star going on there. I had my swagger going on there. That's where that swagger came from.
But that idea of Sunday church dressing
was a big deal. All was forgiven if you made it to the church service on time on Sunday.
That's Southern church going, if nothing else. See, that's funny to me because that just from watching people in that way and watching people with this hunger to be seen and to be seen in that environment, there's so many people showing up and wanting to make an impact and wanting to make an impact on the reverend. And that when you the procession line going up after services, and you want to be seen and make a certain kind of impact. I mean, these things all come into play in some way in these characters that you play.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Thanks, church.
See, you may be the first person who's ever brought this up on the show. And I take that back.
Great.
You are the first person who brought this up.
Yes.
But no, because it's as you're talking about this, that presentational aspect of it and that idea of trying to put your best face on, even though sometimes the cracks will show.
Yeah. I think there's an amazing acting teacher named Susan Batson.
Oh, sure. Who's, legendary, who's profiling in The New Yorker.
Oh, is she?
Yes.
Amazing.
Like
I've never met her, but I read her book years ago, and it really impacted me because those are the things she focuses on the most about a character is the public persona, the need. The need always demands the public persona. And I know talking about acting is boring, but then there's also always a tragic flaw that can interfere with both of those things and make the character combustible. So I think those are three. And when I go through life and I see people, you can always point out those three things. And if you can figure those three out and make them as rich as you can, then I think you're always at least on some kind of a track to the character.
Yeah, because as you're talking about the conflict between the inner life and the presentational.
Yes.
And I think that's got to be part of it too, that physical approach gives you a way to deal so often because we go back to Last Tycoon, there are often scenes where he was just listening rather than talking, but active in that listening in the way that he wanted to know people were, he knew that people were paying attention to him as he listened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you see that. I mean, for that character, you know, I had been in the industry long enough that I'd been around in the room with some real power dons, the kind of people who even studio heads want to have good relationships with. You know what I mean? So I was able to kind of watch them a little bit. And typically they are very wise, gracious people who are really good listeners, but are, like you said, aware that they are being listened to as well and being paid attention to while they're listening.
See, that's a fascinating thing. I guess this feels like a Southern thing to me because I have family from the South, from Mississippi, and I spent a lot of time in Texas. I worked in Fort Worth for 2 years, so I know Texas a bit.
Yeah.
And that sort of that conflict of, how best to put this, kind of humility, but not really.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And a lot of, like we were talking about, public persona, private persona.
But that idea of wanting to be noticed for being humble, I mean, or
yeah,
being
exactly.
or kind of a false or presentational modesty.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you meet people who really are just the real deal, you know what I mean?
Oh,
who
sure.
have just really have gotten to a place of where their morals are just really in line with what they believe and who they want to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think, though, to get back to Poppy Chulo a little bit, that idea of him, again, kind of a hunger. I mean, one of my favorite scenes is when the ride in the Uber, which goes through so many different colorations, from kind of a, just being lost in a moment to finally being aware. I mean, being so lost that he makes a desperate reach for affection to then suddenly being caught up in. I mean, that's a lot to play out and not dialogue without having dialogue that addresses any of that.
No, all we had was we sing a Madonna song together that comes on the radio in between.
But that 3 minute stretch, there's a whole lot that goes on.
Yeah, yeah.
And just talk about playing that a little bit because there's so much that happens.
Oh, man. That was such a fun scene to get to do. We've come from this party where I've introduced Ernesto to a lot of my friends. Ernesto and I don't speak a lot of Spanish, and he doesn't speak a lot of English. So, we've both had a few drinks. So we're riding back in the car together, and the song "Borderline" by Madonna comes on, and I start to sing along, and then he starts to sing along. And then we have this beautiful moment of connection where music sort of transcends our inability to communicate. And my character takes that as sort of a false sense of permission to try to connect on another level with Ernesto. And Ernesto basically has to lay down a really strong boundary with him. And he realizes, oh, my God, I finally found a human being I connect with, and I've messed this up too.
We're out of time. I'm so sorry. You got to come back and do the show again, please.
I would love that. Anytime.
Okay. Well, let us know what your next project is.
Okay.
My guest is the Prince, Matt Bomer. He's the star of the new film, Poppy Chulo. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Marcia Caldwell. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It is by Blake White. I'm going to go to church. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.